Chapter 49. The Power of the Thing. On a scale of 1 to 43,200, the Great Pyramid serves as a model and map projection of the northern hemisphere of the Earth. What absolutely excludes the possibility that this could be a coincidence is the fact that the scale involved is keyed in numerically to the rate of precession of the equinoxes, one of the Earth's most characteristic planetary mechanisms. It is therefore clear that we are confronted here by the manifestation of a deliberate planning decision, one intended to be recognizable as such by any culture which had acquired A, an accurate knowledge of the dimensions of the Earth, and B, an accurate knowledge of the rate of precessional motion. Thanks to the work of Robert Bovall, we can now be certain that another deliberate planning decision was implemented in the Great Pyramid, which, it is increasingly apparent, must be understood as a device designed to fulfill many different functions. In this case, the plan was a truly ambitious one, involving the second and third pyramids as well, but it bears the fingerprints of the same ancient architects and builders who conceived of the Great Pyramid as a scale model of the Earth. Their hallmark seems to have been precession, perhaps because they liked its mathematical regularity and predictability. And they used precession to devise a plan which could be understood properly only by a scientifically advanced culture. Ours is such a culture, and Robert Bovall is the first to have worked out the basic parameters of the plan, a discovery for which he has received public acclaim and will in due course get the scientific recognition he deserves. Belgian by nationality, born and brought up in Alexandria, he's a tall, lean, clean-shaven 40-something, and going a little thin on top. His most notable feature is a stubborn lower jaw, which characterizes his tenacious, inquiring personality. He speaks with a hybrid French-Egyptian-English accent and is decidedly oriental in his manner. He has a first-class mind and is always restlessly accumulating and analyzing new data relevant to his interests, finding new ways to look at old problems. In the process, entirely by accident, he has succeeded in transforming himself into a kind of magician of esoteric knowledge. The Orion Mystery. The roots of Bovall's discoveries at Giza go back to the 1960s, when the Egyptologist and architect Dr. Alexander Badawi and the American astronomer Virginia Trimble demonstrated that the southern shaft of the King's Chamber in the Great Pyramid was targeted like a gun barrel on the belt of Orion during the Pyramid Age, around 2600 to 2400 BC. Bovall decided to test the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber, which Badawi and Trimble had not investigated, and established that it had been sighted on the star Sirius during the Pyramid Age. The evidence that proved this was provided by the German engineer Rudolf Gantenbrink, as a result of measurements taken by his robot Upwout in March 1993. This was the robot that had made the startling discovery of a closed portcullis door blocking the shaft at a distance of about 200 feet from the Queen's Chamber. Equipped with a high-tech onboard clinometer, the little machine had also provided the first ever completely accurate reading of the shaft's angle of inclination, 39 degrees, 30 minutes. As Bovall explains, "I did the calculations, and these established that the shaft had been targeted on the meridian transit of Sirius around the epoch of 2400 BC. There couldn't be any doubt about it at all. I also recalculated the Orion's belt alignment, worked out by Badawi and Trimble, with new data that Gantenbrink gave me on the inclination of the southern shaft of the King's Chamber. He'd measured that at 45 degrees exactly, whereas Badawi and Trimble had worked with Flinders Petrie's slightly less accurate measurement of 44 degrees 30 minutes. The new data enabled me to refine Badawi's and Trimble's date for the alignment. What I found was that the shaft had been precisely targeted on Al-Nitak, the lowest of the three belt stars, which crossed the meridian at altitude 45 degrees around the year 2475 BC. Up to this point, Bovall's conclusions had been well within the chronological bounds set by orthodox Egyptologists, who normally dated the construction of the Great Pyramid to around 2520 BC. If anything, The alignments the archaeoastronomer had come up with suggested that the shafts had been built a little later rather than earlier than conventional wisdom allowed. As the listener is aware, however, Bovall had also made another discovery of an altogether more unsettling nature. Once again, it involved the stars of Orion's belt. They're slanted along a diagonal in a southwesterly direction relative to the axis of the Milky Way, and the pyramids are slanted along a diagonal in a southwesterly direction relative to the axis of the Nile. If you look carefully, on a clear night, you'll also see that the smallest of the three stars, the one at the top, which the Arabs call Mintaka, is slightly offset to the east of the principal diagonal formed by the other two. This pattern is mimicked on the ground, where we see that the pyramid of Menkaure is offset by exactly the right amount to the east of the principal diagonal formed by the pyramid of Khafre, which represents the middle star Al-Nilam, and the Great Pyramid, which represents Al-Nitak. It's really quite obvious that all these monuments were laid out according to a unified site plan that was modeled with extraordinary precision on those three stars. What they did at Giza was to build Orion's belt on the ground. There was more to come. Using a sophisticated computer program capable of plotting the precessionally induced changes in the declinations of all stars visible in the sky over any part of the world in any epoch, Bovall found that the pyramid's Orion's belt correlation was general and obvious in all epochs, but specific and exact in only one. At 10,450 BC, and at that date only, we find that the pattern of the pyramids on the ground provides a perfect reflection of the pattern of the stars in the sky. I mean, it's a perfect match, faultless, and it cannot be an accident because the entire arrangement correctly depicts two very unusual celestial events that occurred only at that time. First, and purely by chance, the Milky Way, as visible from Giza in 10,450 BC, exactly duplicated the meridional course of the Nile Valley. Secondly, to the west of the Milky Way, the three stars of Orion's belt were at the lowest altitude in their precessional cycle, with Al-Nitak, the star representing the Great Pyramid, crossing the meridian at 11 degrees 08 minutes. The listener is already familiar with the way the Earth's axial precession causes sunrise on the vernal equinox to migrate along the band of the zodiac over a cycle of about 26,000 years. The same phenomenon also affects the declination of all visible stars, producing, in the case of the Orion constellation, very gradual but significant changes in altitude. Thus, from its highest point at meridian transit, 58 degrees, 11 minutes above the southern horizon as viewed from Giza, it takes Al-Nitak about 13,000 years to descend to the low point, last registered in 10,450 BC, that is immortalized in stone on the Giza Plateau, that is 11 degrees and 8 minutes. As another 13,000 years pass, the belt stars very slowly rise again, until Al-Nitak is back at 58 degrees 11 minutes. Then during the next 13,000 years, they gradually fall once more to 11 degrees 08 minutes. This cycle is eternal. 13,000 years up, 13,000 years down. 13,000 years up, 13,000 years down, forever. It's the precise configuration for 10,450 BC that we see on the Giza Plateau, as though a master architect came here in that epoch and decided to lay out a huge map on the ground using a mixture of natural and artificial features. He used the meridional course of the Nile Valley to depict the Milky Way as it looked then. He built the three pyramids to represent the three stars exactly as they looked then, and he put the three pyramids in exactly the same relationship to the Nile Valley as the three stars then had to the Milky Way. It was a very clever, very ambitious, very exact way to mark an epoch, to freeze a particular date into architecture, if you like. The first time. I found the implications of the Orion correlation complicated and eerie. On the one hand, the Great Pyramid's southern shafts precessionally anchored the monument to Al-Nitak and Sirius in 2475 to 2400 BC, dates which coincided comfortably with the epoch when Egyptologists said the monument had been built. On the other hand, the disposition of all three of the pyramids in relation to the Nile Valley eloquently signaled the much earlier date of 10,450 BC. This coincided with the controversial geological findings John West and Robert Schock had made at Giza, which suggested the presence of a high civilization in Egypt in the 11th millennium BC. Moreover, the disposition of the pyramids had not been arrived at by any random or accidental process, but seemed to have been deliberately chosen because it marked a precessionally significant event, the lowest point, the beginning, the first time, in Orion's 13,000-year upcycle. I knew that Bovard believed this astronomical event to have been linked symbolically to the mythical first time of Osiris, the time of the gods, when civilization had supposedly been brought into the Nile Valley, and that his reasoning for this derived from the mythology of ancient Egypt, which directly associated Osiris with the Orion constellation and Isis with Sirius. Had the historical archetypes for Osiris and Isis actually come here in the first time, 12,500 years ago? My research into Ice Age mythologies had persuaded me that certain ideas and memories could linger in the human psyche for many millennia, transmitted from generation to generation by oral tradition. I could therefore see no prima facie reasons why the Assyrian mythology, with its strange and anomalous characteristics, should not have originated as far back as 10,450 BC. However, it was the civilization of dynastic Egypt that had elevated Osiris to the status of the high god of resurrection. That civilization was one that had few known antecedents, and none at all recognizable in the remote epoch of the 11th millennium BC. If the Osirian mythology had been transmitted across 8,000 years, therefore, then what culture had transmitted it? And had this culture also been responsible for both the astronomical alignments proven to have been manifested by the pyramids, 10,450 BC and 2,450 BC? These were among the questions I planned to put to Robert Bovall in the shadow of the pyramids. Santha and I had arranged to meet him at dawn at the mortuary temple of Khafre so that the three of us could watch the sun come up over the Sphinx. The platform. Positioned beside the eastern face of the second pyramid, the largely ruined mortuary temple was a spooky, grey, cold place to be at this hour. And as John West had indicated during our conversation at Luxor, there could be little doubt that it belonged to the same severe, imposing, and unadorned style of architecture as the better-known Valley Temple. Here, at any rate, were the same enormous blocks, weighing 100 tons or more each, and here, too, was the same intangible atmosphere of vast antiquity and awakened intelligence, as though some epiphany might be at hand. Even in its present, much despoiled state, this anonymous structure, which Egyptologists had called a mortuary temple, was still a place of power that seemed to draw its energy from an epoch far in the past. I looked up at the huge mass of the second pyramid's eastern face, just behind us in the pearl-grey dawn light. Again, as John West had pointed out, there was much to suggest that it might have been built in two different stages. The lower courses, up to a height of perhaps 40 feet, consisted largely of cyclopean limestone megaliths, like those in the temples. Above this height, however, the remainder of the pyramid's gigantic core had been formed out of much smaller blocks, weighing around 2 to 3 tons each, like the majority of the blocks in the Great Pyramid. Had there been a time when a 12-acre, 40-foot-high megalithic platform had stood here on the Hill of Giza, west of the Sphinx, surrounded only by nameless square and rectangular structures, such as the Valley and mortuary temples? In other words, was it possible that the second pyramid's lower courses might have been built first, before the other pyramids, perhaps long before, in a much earlier age? the cult? That question was still ringing on my mind when Robert Bovall arrived. After exchanging a few chilly pleasantries about the weather, a cold desert wind was blowing across the plateau, I asked him, "How do you account for the 8,000-year gap in your correlations?" "Gap?" "Yes, shafts that seem to have been aligned in 2450 BC, and a site plan that maps star positions in 10,450 BC. "Actually, I see two explanations that both make some kind of sense," said Bovall. "And I think the answer has to be one or the other of these. Either the pyramids were designed as a sort of star clock to mark two particular epochs, 2450 and 10,450 BC, in which case we actually can't say when they were built. Or they were built up over..." "Hang on with that first point," I interrupted. "How do you mean star clock? How do you mean we can't say when they were built?" "Well," replied Bovall, "let's assume for a moment that the pyramid builders knew precession. Let's assume that they were able to calculate the declination of particular star groups backwards and forwards in time, just as we can today with computers. Assuming they could do that, then no matter which epoch they'd lived in, they'd have been able to make a model of what the skies over Giza looked like in 10,450 BC or 2,450 BC as required, just as we could. In other words, if they'd built the pyramids in 10,450 BC, they would have had no difficulty in calculating the correct angles of inclination for the southern shafts, so that they would be sited on Al-Nitak and Sirius around 2,450 BC. Likewise, if they'd lived in 2,450 BC, they'd have had no difficulty in calculating the correct site plan to reflect the position of Orion's belt in 10,450 BC. Agreed? "Agreed," I said. "Okay," Bovall continued, "that's one explanation. But the second explanation, which I personally favour, and which I think the geological evidence also supports, is that the whole Giza necropolis was developed and built up over an enormously long period of time. I think it's more than possible that the site was originally planned and laid out at around 10,450 BC, so that its geometry would reflect the skies as they looked then, and that the work was completed and the shafts of the Great Pyramid aligned around 2,450 BC. So you're saying that the ground plan of the pyramids could date back to 10,450 BC? "I think it does," Bovall confirmed. "And I think that the geometrical center of that plan was located more or less where we're standing now, right in front of the second pyramid. I pointed out the large blocks in the lower courses of the huge edifice. It even looks like it was built in two stages, by two completely different cultures." Bovall shrugged. "Let's speculate," he said. "Maybe it wasn't two different cultures. Maybe it was one culture, or cult, the cult of Osiris, perhaps. Maybe it was a very long-lived, very ancient cult, dedicated to Osiris, that was here in 10,450 BC and was still here in 2,450 BC. Maybe what happened was that some of the ways that this cult did things changed over time. Maybe they used huge blocks in 10,450 BC and smaller blocks in 2,450 BC. It seems to me there's a lot here that supports this notion, a lot that says very ancient cult, a lot of evidence that has just never been investigated." "For example?" I asked. "Well," Bovall replied, "obviously the astronomical alignments of the site. I've been among the first to start looking into those properly, and the geology, the work that John West and Robert Schock have been involved in at the Sphinx. Here are two sciences, both hard, empirical, evidence-driven sciences, that have never been applied to these problems before. But now that we've started to apply them, we're beginning to get a whole new reading on the antiquity of the necropolis, and I honestly think we've just scratched the surface, and that much more will emerge from the geology and the astronomy in the future. In addition, nobody's yet made a really detailed study of the pyramid texts from anything other than the so-called anthropological perspective, which means a preconceived notion that the priests of Heliopolis were a bunch of half-civilized witch doctors who wanted to live forever. Actually, they did want to live forever, but they certainly weren't witch doctors. They were highly civilized, highly initiated men, and they were in their own fashion scientists, as we can judge from their works. Therefore, I suggest that it's a scientific, or at least quasi-scientific documents that the pyramid texts need to be read, not as mumbo-jumbo. I'm already satisfied that they respond to precessional astronomy. There may be other keys too, mathematics, geometry, particularly geometry, symbolism. What's needed is a multidisciplinary approach to understanding the pyramid texts and to understanding the pyramids themselves. Astronomers, mathematicians, geologists, engineers, architects, even philosophers to deal with the symbolism, everybody who can bring a fresh eye and fresh skills to bear on these very important problems should be encouraged to do so. Why, I asked, do you feel the problems are so important? Bhaval replied, because they have a colossal bearing on our understanding of the past of our own species. The very careful, very precise site planning and setting out that appears to have been done here in 10,450 BC could only have been the work of a highly evolved, probably technological civilization. Whereas no such civilization is supposed to have existed anywhere on Earth in that epoch. Exactly, said Bhaval. It was the Stone Age. Human society was supposed to have been at a very primitive level, with our ancestors wearing skins, sheltering in caves, following a hunting-gathering way of life, and so on and so forth. So it's rather unsettling to discover that civilized people seem to have been present at Giza in 10,450 BC, who understood the obscure science of precession extremely well, who had the technical capacity to work out that they were witnessing the lowest point in Orion's precessional cycle, and thus the beginning of the constellation's 13,000-year upward journey, and who set out to create a permanent memorial of that moment here on the plateau. By putting Orion's belt on the ground in the way that they did, they knew that they were freezing a very specific moment in time. A perverse thought occurred to me. How can we be so sure that the moment they were freezing was 10,450 BC? After all, Orion's belt takes up that same configuration in the southern sky, west of the Milky Way, at 11 plus degrees above the horizon, once every 26,000 years. So why shouldn't they have been immortalizing 36,450 BC, or even the precessional cycle that began 26,000 years before that? Robert was clearly ready for this question. Some ancient records do suggest that Egyptian civilization had roots going back almost 40,000 years, he mused, like that strange report in Herodotus that talks about the sun rising where it once set and setting where it once rose, which is also a processional metaphor. Yes, precession again, most peculiar the way it keeps cropping up. At any rate, you're right, they could have been marking the beginning of the previous precessional cycle. But do you think they were, I asked. No, Bhaval replied. I think 10,450 BC is the more likely date. It's more within the range of what we know about the evolution of Homo sapiens, and although it still leaves a lot of years to account for before the sudden emergence of dynastic Egypt around 3,000 BC, it isn't too long a period. Too long a period for what? Bhaval smiled. It's the answer to your question about the 8,000-year gap between the alignment of the site and the alignment of the shafts. 8,000 years is a very long time, but it isn't too long for a dedicated, highly motivated cult to have preserved and nurtured and faithfully passed on the high knowledge of the people who invented this place in 10,450 BC. The machine. How high was the knowledge of those prehistoric inventors? They knew their epoch, said Bhaval, and the clock that they used was the natural clock of the stars. Their working language was precessional astronomy, and these monuments express that language in a very clear, unambiguous scientific manner. They were also highly skilled surveyors. I mean the people who originally prepared the site and laid out the orientations for the pyramids, because they worked to an exacting geometry, and because they knew how to align the base platforms, or whatever it was they built, perfectly to the cardinal points. Do you think, I asked, that they also knew that they were marking out the site of the Great Pyramid on latitude 30 degrees north? Bhaval laughed. I'm certain they knew. I think they knew everything about the shape of the earth. They knew their astronomy. They had a good understanding of the solar system and of celestial mechanics. They were also incredibly accurate and incredibly precise in everything they did. So all in all, I don't think anything really happened here by chance, at least not between 10,450 and 2,450 BC. I get the feeling that everything was planned, intended, carefully worked out. Indeed, I get the feeling that they were fulfilling a long-term objective, some kind of purpose, if you like, and that they brought this to fruition in the third millennium BC. In the form of the fully built pyramids, which they then precessionally anchored to Al-Nitak and to Sirius at the time of completion. Yes, Bhaval agreed, and also, I think, in the form of the pyramid texts. My guess is that the pyramid texts are part of the puzzle. The software, I suggested, to the pyramid's hardware? Quite possibly, Bhaval replied. Why not? At any rate, it's certain that there's a connection. I think what it means is that if we're going to decode the pyramids properly, then we're going to have to use the texts. What's your guess, I asked Bhaval. What do you think the purpose of the pyramid builders really might have been? They didn't do it because they wanted an eternal tomb, he replied firmly. In my view, they had no doubts at all that they would eternally live. They did it, whoever did it, they have transmitted the power of their ideas through something that is to all intents and purposes eternal. They succeeded in creating a force that is functional in itself, provided you understand it, and that force is the questions it challenges you to ask. My guess is that they knew the human mind to perfection. They knew the game of ritual, right? I'm serious. They knew what they were doing. They knew that they could initiate people far ahead in the future into their way of thinking, even though they couldn't be there themselves. They knew they could do this by creating an eternal machine, the function of which was to generate questions. I suppose that I must have looked puzzled. The machine is the pyramids, Bhaval explained. The whole of the Giza necropolis, really. And look at us. What are we doing? We're asking questions. We're standing out here, shivering, at an ungodly hour, watching the sun come up, and we're asking questions. Lots and lots of questions, just as we've been programmed to do. We're in the hands of real magicians here, and real magicians know that with symbols, with the right symbols, with the right questions, they can lead you into initiating yourself. Provided, that is, you are a person who asks questions. And if you are, then the minute you start asking questions about the pyramids, you begin to stumble into a whole series of answers, which lead you to other questions, and then more answers, until finally, you initiate yourself. Sow the seed. Yes, they were sowing the seed. Believe me, they were magicians, and they knew the power of ideas. They knew how to set ideas growing and developing in people's minds. And if you start with such ideas, and follow the process of reasoning like I did, you arrive at things like Orion and 10,450 BC. In short, this is a process that works on its own. When it enters, when it settles into the subconscious, it is a self-willing conversion. Once it's there, you can't even resist it. You're talking, I interrupted, as though this Giza cult, whatever it was, revolving around precession and geometry and the pyramid texts, you're talking as though it still exists. In a sense, it does still exist, Robert replied. Even if the driver is no longer at the wheel, the Giza necropolis is still a machine that was designed to provoke questions. He paused and pointed up to the summit of the Great Pyramid, where Santa and I had climbed at dead of night 9 months previously. Look at its power, he continued. 5,000 years on, it still gets you. It involves you whether you like it or not. It forces you into a process of thinking, forces you to learn. The minute you ask a question about it, you've asked a question about engineering. You've asked a question about geometry. You've asked a question about astronomy. So it forces you to learn about engineering and geometry and astronomy, and gradually you begin to realize how sophisticated it is, how incredibly clever and skillful and knowledgeable its builders must have been, which forces you to ask questions about mankind, about human history, eventually about yourself too. You want to find out. This is the power of the thing. The second signature. As Robert Santa and I sat out on the Giza Plateau that cold December morning at the end of 1993, we watched the winter sun, now very close to solstice, rising over the right shoulder of the Sphinx almost as far south of east as it would travel on its yearly journey before turning north again. The Sphinx was an equinoctial marker, with its gaze directed precisely at the point of sunrise on the vernal equinox. Was it, too, part of Giza's grand plan? I reminded myself that in any epoch, and at any period of history or prehistory, the Sphinx's due east gaze would always have been sighted on the equinoctial rising of the sun at both the vernal and the autumnal equinoxes. As the listener will recall from Part 5, however, it was the vernal equinox that was considered by ancient man to be the marker of the astronomical age. In the words of Santillana and von Deschend, the constellation that rose in the east just before the sun marked the place where the sun rested. It was known as the sun's carrier, and the vernal equinox was recognized as the fiducial point of the system, determining the first degree of the sun's yearly cycle. Why should an equinoctial marker have been made in the shape of a giant lion? In our own lifetimes, the epoch of AD 2000, a more suitable shape for such a marker, should anyone wish to build one, would have been a representation of a fish. This is because the sun on the vernal equinox rises against the stellar background of Pisces, as it has done for approximately the last 2,000 years. The astronomical age of Pisces began around the time of Christ. Listeners must judge for themselves whether it is a coincidence that the principal symbol used for Christ by the very early Christians was not the cross, but the fish. During the preceding age, which broadly speaking encompassed the first and second millennia BC, it was the constellation of Aries, the ram, which had the honor of carrying the sun on the vernal equinox. Again, listeners must judge whether it is a coincidence that the religious iconography of that epoch was predominantly ram-oriented. Is it a coincidence, for example, that Yahweh, God of Old Testament Israel, provided a ram as a substitute for Abraham's offered sacrifice of his son Isaac? Abraham and Isaac are assumed by biblical scholars and archaeologists to have lived during the early second millennium BC. Is it likewise coincidental that rams, in one context or another, are referred to in almost every book of the Old Testament, entirely composed during the Age of Aries, but in not a single book of the New Testament? And is it an accident that the advent of the Age of Aries, shortly before the beginning of the second millennium BC, was accompanied in ancient Egypt by an upsurge in the worship of the god Amon, whose symbol was a ram with curled horns? Work on the principal sanctuary of Amon, the Temple of Karnak at Luxor in Upper Egypt, was begun at around 2000 BC, and as those who visited that temple will recall, its principal icons are rams, long rows of which guard its entrances. The immediate predecessor to the Age of Aries was the Age of Taurus, the bull, which spanned the period between 4380 and 2200 BC. It was during this precessional epoch, when the sun on the vernal equinox rose in the constellation of Taurus, that the bull cult of Minoan Crete flourished. And during this epoch too, the civilization of dynastic Egypt burst upon the historical scene, fully formed, apparently without antecedents. Listeners must judge whether it is a coincidence that Egyptians at the very beginning of the dynastic period were already venerating the Apis and Mnevis bulls, the former being considered a theophany of the god Osiris, and the latter, the sacred animal of Heliopolis, a theophany of the god Ra. Why should an equinoctial marker have been made in the form of a lion? I looked down the slope of the Giza Plateau towards the great leonine body of the Sphinx. Khafre, the fourth dynasty pharaoh, believed by Egyptologists to have carved the monument out of bedrock around 2500 BC, had been a monarch of the Age of Taurus. For almost 1,800 years before his reign, and more than 300 years after it, the sun on the vernal equinox rose unfailingly in the constellation of the Bull. It follows that if a monarch at such a time had set out to create an equinoctial marker at Giza, he would have had every reason to have it carved in the form of a bull, and none whatsoever to have it carved in the form of a lion. Indeed, and it was obvious, there was only one epoch when the celestial symbolism of a leonine equinoctial marker would have been appropriate. That epoch was, of course, the Age of Leo, from 10,970 to 8,810 BC. Why, therefore, should an equinoctial marker have been made in the shape of a lion? Because it was made during the Age of Leo, when the sun on the vernal equinox rose against the stellar background of the constellation of the lion, thus marking the coordinates of a precessional epoch that would not experience its great return for another 26,000 years. Around 10,450 BC, the three stars of Orion's belt reached the lowest point in their precessional cycle, west of the Milky Way, 11 degrees 08 minutes above the southern horizon at meridian transit. On the ground, west of the Nile, this event was frozen into architecture in the shape of the three pyramids of Giza. Their layout formed the signature of an unmistakable epoch of precessional time. Around 10,450 BC, the sun on the vernal equinox rose in the constellation of Leo. On the ground at Giza, this event was frozen into architecture in the shape of the Sphinx, a gigantic leonine equinoctial marker, which, like the second signature on an official document, could be taken as a confirmation of authenticity. The 11th millennium BC, in other words, soon after the mill of heaven broke, shifting sunrise on the spring equinox from Virgo into the constellation of Leo, was the only epoch in which the due east-facing Sphinx would have manifested exactly the right symbolic alignment on exactly the right day, watching the vernal sun rising in the dawn sky against the background of his own celestial counterpart. Forcing the question. It can't be a coincidence that such a perfect alignment of the terrestrial and the celestial occurs at around 10,450 BC, said Robert. In fact, I don't think coincidence is any longer an issue. To me, the real question is why? Why was it done? Why did they go to such lengths to make this enormous statement about the 11th millennium BC? Obviously, because it was an important time for them, suggested Santa. It must have been very, very important, replied Boval. You don't do something like this, create a series of vast precessional markers like these, carve a sphinx, put up three pyramids weighing almost 15 million tons, unless you have some hugely important reason. So the question is, what was that reason? They forced this question by making such a strong, imperative statement about 10,450 BC. Really, they forced the question. They want to draw our attention to 10,450 BC, and it's up to us to work out why. We fell silent for a long while as the sun climbed the sky southeast of the Great Sphinx.